Listeners of Undisclosed, you've been asking us for weeks how you can support Mr. Harold Perry, our special guest from the second addendum. Well, I'm going to tell you how in the credits. Essentially, we've partnered with a Baltimore nonprofit, and I'm really excited to tell you about it, so stick around for the credits to find out how you can help. And now, Undisclosed, The Killing of Freddie Gray, Episode 6, is brought to you by Casper Mattresses. Make sure you listen in for the Casper spot later in the show and support Casper because Casper supports us. Also, the reminder to listeners that the research, analysis, and opinions of the investigators, journalists, academics, and lawyers who you'll hear on the program about the circumstances surrounding Freddie Gray's killing are just that. Research, analysis, and opinions. We encourage listeners to reach their own conclusions and to vigorously debate our conclusions with us. Enjoy the program.
It took six stops of the van, allegedly, to get Freddie Gray from where he was arrested and detained to the Western District Station. Stops 1 and 2 were documented with video footage, though it's still unclear and disputed what actually happened in those places. But then we get to the next 2 stops, 3 and 4, and the waters get even muddier. So muddy that, to be honest, we aren't even sure if they really happened. Hi and welcome to Undisclosed, The Killing of Freddie Gray. My name is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and the author of the book Adnan Story, and I'm here with my colleagues Justine Barron, Amelia McDonald Perry, and Marcia Chatlin.
My name is Amelia McDonald Perry, and I'm a former blog editor and a journalist for RollingStone.com and CrimeFeed.
I'm Marcia Chatlin. I'm an associate professor of history and African American studies at Georgetown University, and I'm also an Eric and Wendy Schmidt Fellow at the New America Foundation.
My name is Justine Barron. I'm a screenwriter, researcher, and columnist at the Jewish Journal.
Quick reminder, here was the story Baltimore police shared during the first week after Freddie Gray's arrest as he lay in a coma. At stop 1, on Presbury near Mount, Freddie was arrested. At stop 2, at Mount and Baker, Freddie was placed in additional restraints. About a half hour later, Freddie arrived at the Western District Station unconscious. Reminder, the police station is 5 blocks from stop 2, so this story had a large, suspicious time gap. It would seem like BPD shared only as much as they had to. Kevin Moore's cell phone video and media interviews with eyewitnesses at stops 1 and 2 left them no choice. Then Freddie died on April 19th, and the next day, moments after expressing their condolences to the Gray family, BPD officials finally disclosed that he had been charged with possession of a switchblade. They also filled in the 30-minute gap. They not only shared 2 more stops, but they also shared that the van was actually headed to Central Booking and Intake Center. Central Booking wasn't just a destination. It provided a new meaning for the reason behind Stop 2. As Deputy Commissioner Rodriguez said about Stop 2 on the 20th.
At approximately 08:46 and 2 seconds, the driver of the van, of the transport van, believes that Mr. Gray is acting irate in the back. At about 8:46 and 12 seconds at Mount and Baker, 1 block to the south and east, a unit asks the wagon to stop so that the paperwork can be completed. And at that point, Gray is placed in leg irons and put back in the wagon. At approximately 8:54 and 2 seconds, the wagon clears Mount Street heading towards Central Booking, going southbound.
What Rodriguez doesn't spell out, but we learned during the trials, was that the paperwork filled out at Stop 2 allowed the officers to send Freddie to Central Booking. As noted, this information revealed on the 20th came from the KGA radio, so BPD leadership presumably knew about it for a week. They waited until the day after Freddie Gray died to release it. We wonder, what story would they have shared if Freddie had continued to live? The Central Booking and Intake Facility opened in 1995 in downtown Baltimore. It was designed to centralize, streamline, and modernize booking that was happening at the 9 district stations. Central Booking would manage mugshots, fingerprinting, intake, and the holding of prisoners in its 120 cells. This would allow officers to return to their shifts quickly. Central Booking would also process prisoners more quickly through the bail system via video links to courtrooms and network processing of paperwork. Today, people who are arrested in Baltimore end up at Central Booking when they are charged, but they don't always end up there right away. There is a policy that officers are supposed to bring the people they arrest first to the district station for what they call debriefing before sending them to Central Booking. Officer Miller describes this policy during Nero's trial. As he explains, prisoners are initially debriefed at the station by the District Detective Unit, DDU, or sometimes patrol officers. They are asked to share any information about, quote, crime in the community. So the debriefing is not usually related to the arrest. Intelligence gathering is considered the foundation of best practices in policing. As other cops have explained, this is supposed to be a friendly conversation. Officially, it is not supposed to lead to reduced or dropped charges, but favors are still often returned. Still, this policy seems problematic to me, specific to policing in urban communities of color. I can't imagine if I ever got arrested for shoplifting at a suburban mall that I would be asked about other crime at the mall, or that I would be encouraged to snitch about unrelated crimes. Even the appearance of snitching can be dangerous. Anyway, officers do not always send prisoners back to the district for debriefing. Sometimes they send them straight to Central Booking. I asked one former BPD officer how often prisoners get debriefed. He said about half the time, but he wasn't sure. We've looked through dozens of case files and found that, indeed, about half of the statements we've read end with language like, quote, the prisoner was transported to the Western District for debriefing. Once debriefing was completed, he was transported to CBIF by wagon for processing. CBIF stands for Central Booking and Intake Facility. Otherwise, the statements will usually conclude, quote, the prisoner was transported by wagon to CBIF, without the debriefing part. Either way, Central Booking, or CBIF, is the third act in the large majority of Baltimore police case files. One of the big questions in this case is when and how the bike officers decided that Freddie Gray was to be sent to Central Booking and not back to the Western for a debriefing first.
So Central Booking is one of those challenging puzzles in this case that should be easy to explain. So much was said about it at the trials, but evidence pops up that calls it into question.
The first thing that caused my eyebrow to raise was how Central Booking was introduced into the narrative. As you heard, Rodriguez says the wagon cleared Mount Street on the way to Central Booking. The wagon cleared one stop on the way to another destination, and this was given its own timestamp. Media picked up on this and listed it as if it were one of the stops.
But that language comes from the dispatch radio. Goodson said he cleared Mount.
Right, but there's a lot on the audio that didn't make it into the official timeline. BPD felt it important to emphasize that Central Booking was the destination. Maybe because it's the only thing to explain stop four, which is so far east in the direction of Central Booking.
Yeah, and the official BPD story about Central Booking, which we hear at the trials, was that the officers planned to send Freddie to the Western District after arresting him at stop one to debrief him and then change their minds. The three bike cops met up under Cam 1A, which we can see, and had their little powwow. They decided to send Freddie straight to Central Booking instead. We hear this on the radio, too. The van driver initially tells dispatch that he's headed to the Western District from stop one. Then, 6 seconds later, Miller asks him to meet up with the bike cops. They're gonna stay out, meaning not bringing Freddie to the district. They need to toe tag him, meaning they need to fill out the paperwork for Central Booking.
As usual, nobody has remarked on the horrifying irony of the reference to a toe tag at a morgue.
It's horrible language to use for any living prisoner. They say it in court without blinking.
Miller said he filled out the toe tag at stop two while leaning against a shaking van. So that's two convenient stories in one. Freddie is still active, he's alive, he's banging and shaking, and he's also guilty of a crime.
Stop two is also when Miller was said to swap out his metal handcuffs for flexicuffs, plastic cuffs that belong to the driver. So all of this seems to add up so far. The dispatch call, the paperwork, and the cuffs. Freddie was going to Central Booking from stop two, it seemed.
Right. They said they changed their minds. But they don't say why they changed their minds. To me, this is a huge omission. So a police source told me that there was a rumor going around BPD that the cops changed their minds about debriefing Freddie because he was being difficult at stop one and because he made Lieutenant Rice run. Old school, this would have been called a run tax. If you look that up on the Urban Dictionary, it usually involves excessive force. The rumor goes that Freddie would have wanted to be debriefed at the Western District because the detectives there might have known him and gone easy on him. Sending him to central booking was punishment. This is just a secondhand rumor. There are so many rumors swimming around BPD about this case.
What makes more sense to me as a reason is that Rice showed up at the end of the arrest, saw the crowd and people filming, and realized that Freddie needed to be charged with something. That is definitely supported by Kevin Moore's longer arrest video, which wasn't released publicly. We can see Rice angrily shooing away the crowds. So then, yeah, I could see why they would change plans after stop one and send Freddie to be booked at stop two, like they said happened.
We got a hold of the 24-hour incident report, a document created by the Force Investigation Team, which, if you remember from the last episode, is tasked with investigating any death or injury in police custody, which was not presented at trial. It says about stop one, quote, Mr. Gray was placed under arrest, at which time he became very combative. Mr. Gray was placed in the wagon to be transported to CBIF. Mr. Gray remained combative in the wagon, so Officer Goodson stopped the wagon at Mount Street, Baker Street, and placed leg irons on him.
Wow, so they blame Goodson for stop two. According to the audio, though, Miller told him to stop.
Goodson is the only officer named as part of the arrest in this document. Maybe because he didn't give a statement, so he wasn't around the Force Investigation Team offices that afternoon.
But from that report, it sounds like Freddie was being sent to central booking from stop one, and stop two had nothing to do with them filling out a tow tag or changing the van's destination.
Right. Unless it's a mistake or an oversight. It's not that detailed. Nero's statement that day does also say that they are sending Freddie to central booking after stop two, but he doesn't mention a change of plans either. He says what the 24-hour report says, that Freddie was being loud and flailing. That whole theory of them changing their plans after stop one didn't really appear solidly until the trials, at least from what we've seen and heard. By the way, this report has almost the exact same boilerplate language as many other reports and affidavits.
We know they couldn't have intended to send Freddie to central booking straight from stop one. First of all, Goodson tells dispatch that he's going to Western. Second, they haven't filled out any paperwork or requested a complaint number from dispatch while they were at stop one. And central booking doesn't just take anyone. Prisoners need to be charged with something.
I think we must sound crazy, like torturing ourselves over whether Freddie was headed to central booking after stop one or stop two, if at all. But it's so important to the case. The version at trials provides the rationale for so much that seems odd. Like how all the same day reports say he is going to central booking from stop one, but Goodson says he's going to Western on the radio, and the videos don't show them swapping cops or filling out paperwork. So the switch in the story to this happening at stop two, which is missing video footage, is very convenient.
What would really help to verify the central booking story is the tow tag document. I want to see what complaint number or CC number is written on it. There's a moment on the audio for stop two when we hear Miller request a CC number from the dispatcher. She provides a number, but it's not the same number that ends up on the charging documents in Freddie's permanent file, which Miller filled out late that night. Instead, the charging documents include the complaint number for the investigation into Freddie's injury in custody.
I talked to some cops about this. It turns out that one complaint number is always used for different cases within one larger incident. So it's not weird at all that Freddie's charge and the investigation into his injury have one CC number. It should have been the first one issued, the one Miller got from dispatch, but that kind of mistake happens. What is weird, very weird, is that the number dispatch read aloud to Miller, it's not in the database of complaint numbers. Once a complaint number is generated by dispatch, it exists. It's a complaint that officers have to report on. So even if a complaint number is issued in error, it stays in the database. The officer notes, issued in error. Even if a prisoner is set free without charges, the officer notes that. So it's very, very weird to hear the complaint number over the audio, but not have it be in the database. Not one single police officer we talked to could explain that. Usually we hear from police sources something like, well, that's weird, but it could be a mistake. But here, everyone was stuck. Nobody could explain that the complaint number doesn't seem to exist. I'm not saying they redacted it from the database. I don't think that's possible and it wouldn't have served them. I guess if anything, it calls into question the audio. We take audio dispatch for granted.
Well, yeah, we can hear it on the radio, but we don't know what really happened. Not all of the audio lines up. For instance, during the April 20th press conference, Rodriguez claims that there was an additional reason for stop two, that it wasn't just to fill out the paperwork for central booking. He said the driver pulled over because the prisoner was acting irate, according to something keyed in or said in the police radio at 8:46 and 2 seconds. But here's the thing. Goodson is never heard saying any such thing on any version of the police dispatch audio that we've heard. Plus, at 8:46 and 2 seconds, he was still turning the van around inside Bakebury Court. He hadn't even told dispatch that he was on his way to Western. Why would he alert them to a second stop before he's even left the first? It's so strange that Rodriguez would attribute such a specific timestamp to a radio call about Freddie acting irate that seemingly doesn't exist.
Maybe Rodriguez was mistaken or making up where he heard irate. Another mistake? Then again, the 24-hour incident report gives the same reason for stop two. Freddie was combative. So many reasons were given for stop two. Mostly Freddie and the crowds acting up. Filling out paperwork for central booking came later.
The whole trip to central booking is also undermined by stop five. It doesn't make sense that the van would be so close to central booking. It was just over a mile away. Only to turn around and head back north and west to pick up another prisoner. And a prisoner who would end up playing an important role in this case, but we'll get to that in a week.
Their excuse was that there wasn't another van available to go pick up the other prisoner. But there are a lot of other kinds of transport vehicles, like what they call cage cars. That's also unfortunately named. And there were a lot of cops at stop five. The other prisoner was no flight risk. They could have waited until Freddie was dropped off at central booking.
It's not like they changed their minds again and decided to take Freddie to Western after all. Nero says in his statement that Goodson was supposed to drop off the other prisoner at Western and then start his journey to central booking all over again.
There's one other thing I come back to with the central booking story. This might seem like a stretch, but I can't let it go. So the fastest route to central booking from stop two is not through stops three and four. That adds 6 minutes at least. The streets turn at odd angles. You have to go north to go south. It's much faster to go up to North Avenue and take the expressway into downtown. I know 6 or so minutes isn't really a strong case. Drivers might take streets for other reasons.
Most of this is circumstantial, but putting it all together, it just doesn't add up. The evidence to support the official stop two central booking story is the police dispatch audio. That's it. But the press conferences, paperwork, statements, and hard evidence undermine that story.
Each of which could be excused as one mistake or oversight after another. There's just so many of them. I wonder if someone at BPD took a look at all of these discrepancies and realized that there was a problem, which is why they withheld information for so long.
If there was any lying about Freddie going to central booking, then that would complicate a lot, including where the van was going, the knife charge, the dispatch evidence.
And about what really happened at stop two.
Exhausted, thinks the podcast listener. Her sleep has been really shoddy lately, but she can't understand why. Staying up late? No. Boyfriend snoring, waking her up in the middle of the night? Well, yeah, but she's gotten to the point where she sleeps through that. What, oh what, could it possibly be? And that's where Dennis comes in and tells you how simply wonderful his sleep has been since he got a mattress from Casper. Okay, enough of the third-person narration. Here's me, Dennis from Undisclosed, telling you, our dear listener, that you will sleep better than you ever have on a Casper mattress. The Casper is an obsessively engineered mattress at a shockingly fair price. It's designed, developed, and assembled in the USA. Here's why you're going to sleep better. Casper combines supportive memory foams to create an award-winning sleep surface with just the right sink and just the right bounce. And don't just take it from me. Casper has over 20,000 reviews and an average of 4.8 stars based on Casper, Amazon, and Google reviews. It's quickly becoming the internet's favorite mattress. If my word and the 20,000 reviews aren't enough, then I guess you'll just have to check it out yourself. Try Casper for 100 nights, risk-free, in your own home. If you don't love it, They'll pick it up and refund you everything. Not only that, but you get free shipping and returns to the US and Canada. So right now, get $50 towards any mattress purchase by visiting www.casper.com/undisclosed and using promo code undisclosed. Terms and conditions apply. That's www.casper.com/undisclosed, promo code undisclosed.
After stop two, the only people who can account for Freddie Gray's whereabouts, disposition, and health are police officers. I mean this literally, too. They were the only people to see Freddie, and not just the van with him locked inside. Not that investigators sought out civilians who might have information about the rest of the van's journey, either. Nor did they dig up even close to as much surveillance footage for the remaining three stops as they did for the first two. Shockingly, the van's full route for April 12th has never been disclosed. Not at any press conference or even at trial. And since Officer Goodson has never given a statement or testified about the events of April 12th, we have no clue what his version would be. But what little we do know about the van's route and its remaining stops gives me plenty of reason to side-eye what amounts to a paltry amount of corroborating CCTV footage. After stop two, we can deduce that the van headed south on Mount for three blocks before turning left on Riggs Avenue. Riggs is just at the corner of the Western District Police Station, so very close to the arrest. We can only track the van driving south one block after leaving stop two, to Pressman Street, thanks to CCTV cams 1E and 2B, located on Mount Street. Mount turns into a one-way street in front of the police station, so Goodson had to have turned left before then in order to continue east. The van is next seen on Riggs Avenue and Fremont Street on CCTV 1115, or cam 3A, a little less than a mile east, so he probably turned left on Riggs. There's a cluster of at least 10 CCTV cameras positioned just north of the Western District that could have confirmed this term, but BPD never released that footage. The footage of the van shown at Riggs and Fremont on Cam 3A ends up being important to the state's attorney's case. It's barely 5 minutes long, and the van is only visible for approximately 8 seconds, starting at 8:56 and 50 seconds. We see the van as it rolls through a stop sign on Riggs and makes a right turn onto Fremont Street. That right turn and Officer Goodson's failure to stop beforehand are an important part of what earned him a second-degree depraved heart murder charge from the state's attorney's office. More than a year later, when Goodson stood trial in June 2016, those 8 seconds of footage were the only evidence prosecutors presented of Goodson giving Freddie Gray a rough ride.
So there was a theory that Freddie was a victim of what is called a rough ride, or depending on where you are from, a nickel ride or cowboy ride. No matter what it's called, it's a form of police abuse that has been part of policing for far too long. The fact that vehicles designed to simply transport suspects can be so easily weaponized speaks to the ways the tools of policing can be transformed to harm instead of protect, and to humiliate and intimidate instead of serve. The history of these vehicles is as complicated as their many uses and abuses. Black Maria, paddy wagon, police van, the vehicles that transport the arrested, the inebriated, and the seized to police stations have gone by a variety of names. In Baltimore, police vehicles have evolved from horse-drawn wagons hitched to prisoners' cages and maneuvered by footmen armed with only shackles, to motorized vehicles shortly before World War I, to the holding cells on wheels that can be seen on the streets today. In 1889, citizens of Baltimore wrote letters to the editor imploring the police to cover their patrol wagons. Mr. Joseph G. Johnson wrote, "When a reputable citizen is only charged with an offense and not yet convicted, it certainly is a barbarous outrage to put him in an open wagon and cart him through the streets in charge of an officer. It is advertising the citizen as a criminal when he has not yet been tried. The solution of the matter is that the wagon should be closed." As the Baltimore City Police Department grew its ranks and hold over the city, its vehicles also changed. With each passing era, the police department claimed that each vehicle was safer, more effective, and better for officers and prisoners. In 1921, the Baltimore Police Department added 136 sidecar motorcycles to its crime-fighting fleet. Following an experiment by New York City police, Baltimore outfitted the sidecars with hand and foot cuffs in order to lock the criminals securely to the sidecar. The Baltimore Sun reported, "Not only will a criminal be unable to escape while going around a curve at 70 miles an hour, but he will be jarred loose by collision with stone walls, telephone poles, storefronts, or furniture vans. In case of accident, the motorcycle rider may leap and possibly save himself, but the criminal will, in every case, go down with his sidecar." Larger vehicles, especially the Black Maria, the nickname coming from a racehorse of the same name, were deployed to break up social gatherings deemed too loud or too raucous for the city. In January 1933, the police raided the Golden Dawn, a cabaret in the 700 block of North Calhoun in Harlem Park, the neighborhood south of Sandtown. Jazz music filled the cabaret until 4 a.m., when officers from the Northwestern District parked their police wagon at the club's door and busted in. The Black Maria made 5 trips between the Golden Dawn and the police station. The arrested patrons were described as disgruntled, girls in gay evening wraps, and 10 tuxedo-clad musicians with banjos, cornets, saxophones, and one with a snare drum. Eventually, 29 clubgoers and 10 musicians were dismissed, and the club's manager, William Drake, was fined $25 for disorderly conduct. Jazz club raids like the one on the Golden Dawn appears to have been more inconvenient than anything else. But the sight of the Black Maria, the paddy wagon, and later the police van through the streets of Baltimore meant that something bad could happen, was about to happen, or may have already happened. Improvements in transportation quality did not necessarily mean that those riding inside police vans fared better. In 1957, the local chapter of the NAACP sent a telegram to James Hepburn, the police commissioner, about John W. Smith. After getting arrested for disorderly conduct, the 19-year-old was loaded onto a patrol wagon on the 800 block of North Fulton Street, on the edges of Sandtown. At the time, the NAACP sent their message, Smith was in critical condition at the city's Provident Hospital with a fractured skull. I'll return to police vans, safety, and the many cases since 1957 in which passengers ended up injured, battered, or dead after riding in Baltimore police vehicles in future episodes. But it's important to keep something in mind. What is the use of better policing equipment or even better policies if it doesn't change police behavior?
Like so much else in this case, the rough ride narrative started to take shape just as soon as Freddie Gray was pronounced dead on April 19th. Statements from the mayor, Rodriguez, and even the Fraternal Order of Police all pushed the injury discussion away from the arrest and into the van. "Our position is something happened inside the van. We just don't know what," said Michael Davey, FOP attorney. They all shied away from saying rough ride. They could have been implying some kind of accident. But Commissioner Batts was less shy.
"You talked about the eye chart coming into focus. Is it your sense now that Freddie Gray died as a result of one of these rough rides, or do you believe his injuries were sustained outside of that police car?"
"I think the potential is for both of those."
As we discussed in an earlier episode, the rough ride narrative began to snowball, saturating national and local headlines for days. For the most part, the media was clear in their coverage that the rough ride theory was only speculation. But still, the theory caught on. It's easy to see why. It's an almost uncomfortably catchy phrase given the subject. And it was plausible based on what limited information was available at the time. Rough rides were something people in Baltimore had actually experienced. Sure, there wasn't any evidence yet that Goodson had given Freddie a rough ride, but there was no evidence that he hadn't either. So, did Officer Goodson give Freddy a rough ride? Did he intentionally drive in a manner that would toss his unrestrained passenger around inside the van's metal cabin, causing him pain or discomfort? Was he slamming on brakes, jerking the steering wheel, or weaving through traffic? We don't know, because the only evidence ever presented of Goodson's rough driving were the 8 seconds of footage showing him turning right onto Fremont Street without braking at the stop sign on the corner. If prosecutors believed Cam 3A captured only a few seconds of what was a longer rough ride, they didn't sell it well. There were no witnesses who testified about seeing a police van driving erratically, and there has never been any suggestion of there being additional CCTV footage that supports the rough ride theory. The prosecution focused on the 8 seconds they did have, which, coincidentally enough, they claimed happened to capture the exact moment when Freddie's ride turned deadly. That ill-intended rolling right turn caused Freddie Gray to fall in a manner that broke his neck, the prosecution argued. Those 8 seconds were all the state had to show that Goodson had given Freddie a rough ride. Well, the prosecutors were fairly ambiguous throughout Goodson's trials as to whether his behavior constituted a rough ride or careless driving, but we'll cover that in a future episode. As for whether that rolling right turn could have resulted in Freddie's fatal injury, according to the prosecution's theory, Stop 3 offers proof that it did.
On April 30th, BPD finally revealed the results of the massive task force investigation that then-Commissioner Batts had been touting. The van driver had made another stop. As a reminder, here is then-Deputy Commissioner Kevin Davis.
The second stop has been revealed to us during the course of our investigation and was previously unknown to us. We discovered this new stop based on our thorough and comprehensive and ongoing review of all CCTV cameras and privately owned cameras. And in fact, this new stop was discovered from a privately owned camera. So the new stop by our wagon was at Fremont and Mosier. Again, that's new to us.
This would become known as Stop 3 officially. By second stop, he meant second after the arrest. Davis provided no timestamp for this stop. And isn't that weird? If it came from a store's security camera, those always have timestamps, right? Or else what's the point? BPD didn't share this footage with the public either, or take any questions from reporters. Just, here's the stop, that's our last stop. Good night, folks, we'll see you after the charges. I'm joking, but not really. Remember, this was the press conference that Batts had moved up one whole day, from Friday, May 1st to Thursday, April 30th, out of what he called urgency. Then, Mosby announced her charges the very next day, on Friday. BPD has sworn that they were blindsided. They didn't see the charges coming. Okay. Regarding the previously unknown third stop, reporters identified the store as CR Market, belonging to Jay Wong. Mr. Wong said that detectives had visited his store twice, taking his hard drive with them, but that the backup had been looted during the riots. You'll pardon a moment's paranoia. This was not the first story we had heard of broken or missing cameras in this case. It wasn't even the third. There were the other cameras at Stop 1 and 2 that Rodriguez said were not operational. There was the CCTV film from Stop 2 that was pulled from YouTube because of a glitch, and so on. So I was suspicious about the missing hard drive at Stop 3. Articles about the looting of Mr. Wong's store seemed credible, but I didn't see the store or any stores near it on the incident maps online from the Baltimore riots. So we sent our research assistant, Lane Keniston, to interview the store's owner, Mr. Wong. He was kind and cooperative, and he confirmed pretty much all of the reported story. It's a bit hard to make out because Lane had to interview him from behind glass while he was busy working, and he has limited English proficiency.
They take all camera, all the computers, they take all of them.
They took the computers?
All of them. So I don't have any clip. And police say, police check already. Many times, so.
Jay also recalled the day before the riots when the police checked out his security footage, looking for information about the guy who got killed in the white van, he said. First, two cops showed up in suits, he said.
The police say bingo.
The police said bingo when they came here to talk to you.
I mean, he finds something, but I can see. I just take my customer.
Yeah.
So I don't know what he's finding. You know, I'm not sure.
Then he said another set of police officers came later.
They sent two technician people.
Uh-huh.
After 3 or 4 hours later, I'm not sure, 5 or 6 hours later,
uh-huh.
Two guys come back. I think the technician guys.
So detectives came, found something on his hard drive, and sent technicians to recover. Then his hard drive was looted. It adds up. Not all of my hunches prove golden. When it came to stop three, we returned again and again to the bigger question. Why didn't BPD share a timestamp? Then we received a copy of the video as it was played at trial. It does show a van driver across the street from Jay Wong's store, stop the van and look in the back of the van briefly. He then returns to the driver's seat and takes off in the same direction. I can't give you the exact amount of time he took because the video has no timestamp. No date, no time. Have you ever seen security footage with no date or time? We are also pretty sure that we are not looking directly at the raw footage. There is a sound echo throughout the video while it plays, and at one point, there is a banging noise that does not come from anything in the video. It seems pretty clear that we are watching some device filming the video while it plays, with the timestamp artfully removed. Also, I refer to the driver as he, but the video is not clear enough to make out gender or anything else about the driver. It's not even clear that the driver is wearing the same long sleeves Goodson wore during Freddie's arrest. You can't make out a license plate or anything identifying the van as from the Western District. It's also not clear that the driver is looking at the right side of the van, where Freddie was kept. Only the camera's location could be easily corroborated. The yellow steel clothing donation bin that bumps up against Kevin Wong's store is there, and the buildings across the street match. It is curious, to say the least, that the Freddie Gray Task Force investigation made the discovery of this footage the centerpiece of their investigation. It might suggest something about the kind of case that they were pursuing, one that puts the focus on the driver. Bingo.
According to the state's attorney's office at trial, stop three was proof that Goodson knew something had happened to his passenger just moments before when he made that wide right turn onto Fremont Street. He stopped the van, got out, walked around to the rear, and they surmised, peered in through the right-hand window to check on Freddie. I can't say I was shocked when we finally got the stop three footage and discovered it wasn't timestamped. I just had a feeling it would produce more questions than answers. But I was sort of surprised that the footage did not even come from the original file. There's nothing that authenticates when this video was taken other than the police said so, and the prosecution and relevant defense attorneys stipulated to it in court. From a fact-checking perspective, this is troublesome to me. And from a legal perspective, well, I just can't imagine this going over well with the defense in the average murder trial. Why would Goodson's attorneys stipulate to the admission of evidence against their client that can't be authenticated? We'll share the footage on our social media channels so our listeners can see it for themselves. Unfortunately, there isn't any CCTV footage of stop three, even though Goodson stopped just a block and a half down from where he made that right turn. Hell, his parking spot is not only within view of Cam 3A, but it is one of its zoom points. Alas, stop three was over by the time Cam 3A rotated back around. Goodson supposedly arrived at approximately 8:57 a.m. and was gone 30 seconds later. One other City Watch camera could have caught stop three, CCTV 1116, which we'll call Cam 3B for consistency, is positioned on a building one short block to the east. At one point, it looks directly at the middle of the block where Goodson pulled over. Why wasn't that footage disclosed? Was it rotating in such a way that it happened to miss Goodson's stop on Fremont too? Or was Cam 3B simply, conveniently, not working on April 12th?
Thank you.
The van's fourth stop at Druid Hill Avenue and Dolphin Street was introduced on April 20th as part of the big data dump BPD finally was willing to provide the public after Freddie died. It was also mentioned in early statements by some, although not all, of the officers. In many ways, Stop 4 is just as confusing and mysterious as Stop 3. At 8:59 and 55 seconds, according to the dispatch audio heard at trial, Goodson radioed for backup.
91. Yes, ma'am. Can I have a unit 10 on the Druid Hill and Dolphin? I need to check this prison out.
Let me have a unit Druid Hill and Dolphin.
10-4.
Druid Hill Avenue and Dolphin Street is not part of the Western District. When Goodson turned left onto Lafayette, he officially entered the Central District. The officer responded to his backup call, Unit 43. That's Officer William Porter, who was of course present at Stops 1 and 2. All of what BPD knew about what happened at Stop 4 came from the statement he gave to investigators on April 17th. We found ourselves asking a lot of questions that begin with, why did they wait over the course of our investigation? In this case, why did investigators wait 5 days to officially interview Officer Porter? He was present at stops 1, 2, 4, and 5, and was at the Western District when Freddie Gray was found unresponsive, and he accompanied the medic to shock trauma. Yet Porter didn't give an official statement to police until the 17th, following an informal call with Detective Sarita Teal of the Force Investigation Team 2 days prior. Detective Teal would later testify that she recognized Porter's voice on the police dispatch audio as having been the officer who responded to Goodson's backup request, and she was calling him to find out the details of that stop. April 15th was Porter's day off, and he was apparently on his way out of town. What Porter told Teal made her realize that they needed to get an official statement from him, and soon. On April 17th, Porter was interviewed by Detectives Teal and Charles Anderson down at BPD headquarters. Teal was right. Porter's account of Stop 4 was a big deal. He had not only seen Freddie Gray at that stop, but he had spoken to him and touched him. Porter said in his statement that he parked behind the transport van on Druid Hill Avenue below the Dolphin Street intersection. At trial, Porter's story was more polished and a little different, too. He testified that he parked on the northwest corner and then crossed over to the southwest corner where he said that Goodson had parked. This is misleading, though. CCTV 2019, or Cam4A, is located at Stoddard Court and Druid Hill Avenue, and it would have caught the entirety of Stop 4 if what Porter said was true. I can't help but wonder if Porter's parking spot changed in order to account for his vehicle being missing from all of the Stop 4 footage. Porter and Goodson met at the back of the wagon. Porter said in his statement, but they didn't discuss, why Goodson felt like they needed to check on Freddie Gray. Quote, "I guess he didn't hear him banging around anymore," Porter said. Instead, they just opened both sets of doors and discovered Freddie still lying on his stomach on the floor, where Lieutenant Rice had left him at stop 2. He said, "Help." I said, "What's your deal? What's wrong with you? Why do you need help?" And he says, "Can you help me up?" So I help him up and I'm like, "What's wrong with you?" He doesn't say anything. He just says he needs help. So I said, "Do you need a medic or something?" And he's like, "Yeah, I need a medic." Porter described Freddie as calm, lethargic, and tired, which he attributed to all the banging and kicking he'd been doing earlier. Porter called it an adrenaline dump, a term he would use again in his testimony at trial. Anderson then asked Porter if Freddie was gasping for air. "No, he wasn't gasping for air," Porter responded. "Did he say anything to you?" asked Anderson, clearly fishing for something. Porter reiterated the same story. Asked him if he wanted a medic, he said yes. But according to Detective Teal, Porter had included an additional detail during their April 15th conversation. At Porter's trial, she testified that she had called him specifically about meeting up with Goodson at Druid Hill and Dolphin, and that he had told her that Freddie had said, "I can't breathe," during Stop 4. When Porter took the stand in his own defense, he insisted that he had been referring to what he overheard Freddie saying at Stop 1. Teal, on the other hand, maintained that Stop 1 wasn't the topic of their April 15th conversation, so she couldn't have gotten confused. The prosecution's case against Officer Porter depended largely on this telephone exchange, which they couldn't prove beyond Teal saying it happened and hoping the jury found her credible. Detective Anderson kept trying to get this tidbit out of Porter during their interview on April 17th, returning again and again to his conversation with Freddie at Stop 4. Did he seem to be breathing hard to you? Anderson asked. I didn't hear him breathing hard, Porter parroted back, going on to stutter some more about Freddy expending all his adrenaline, kicking the van so much it was shaking. And after a while, he got tired. Porter also made a point of emphasizing that Freddy hadn't asked for a medic or to go to the hospital, but that Porter had offered both to him. So then why was he so dismissive when Freddy accepted? Everybody plays the I need to go to the hospital thing when they get arrested, Porter told Teal and Anderson, seeming to forget that it was his idea. But it was enough to take central booking off the table. So, I looked at Goodson and I'm like, you need to take this dude to the hospital, Porter explained. We didn't need to call a medic because we had a transport vehicle, so we could just transport him there. We looked at each other like, yeah, he's not going to pass medical down at central booking. When pressed about why he and Goodson didn't call a medic right then and there, Porter insisted, medics don't want to transport prisoners if we already have a wagon available. If a prisoner needs to go to the hospital, you transport them in the wagon. At trial, medic Angelique Herbert testified that while sometimes the police decide to transport prisoners to medical facilities themselves, she has never declined to come to the aid of a prisoner when a police officer has requested it. In our review of dozens of probable cause reports and charging statements, we've seen plenty of references to a medic being called for one reason or another. This should be obvious, though, right? Because ambulances are not simply a way of getting from one destination to another. They're not cabs. You don't stick out your thumb and hail one. Yes, they have wheels, but they also have equipment that can help save lives and are staffed with EMTs who are trained to deal with people in need of medical care. This was why Porter asked Freddy if he needed a medic, no? So why didn't he deliver when Freddy Gray said yes?
Although police vans improved in their design and increasingly could hold more detainees, seatbelts are another story. An element of Freddy's case pivots around the question about whether officers were criminally negligent if they didn't belt him in the seat in the police van. It's important to note that this was not the first time that the Baltimore Police Department had to think about seatbelts and transport safety. In the summer of 1994, Jesse Chapman, a 30-year-old Sandtown resident, was arrested after his girlfriend reported a domestic dispute. Police arrested Chapman in the 1100 block of Fulton Avenue. By the time he arrived at the Western District Police Station, he was dead. The community gathered for rallies in front of the Western District, seeking answers for what happened to Chapman. Local activist Yane Moss told the press, quote, "If we don't stick together, the killings will continue to go on." 3 years later, on September 18, 1997, the Baltimore Police Department issued General Order K-14, instructing officers that whenever a person is taken into custody, they must ensure the safety of the arrestee, ensure medical treatment for a prisoner is obtained, when necessary, at the nearest medical facility. And it also stated, whenever an arrestee is transported in a police vehicle, to ensure that the arrestee is secured with seat or restraint belts provided. This procedure should be evaluated on an individual basis so not to place oneself in any danger. That the seat restraint is placed securely around the waist or upper body of the arrestee to prevent the arrestee from maneuvering out of the restraint and possibly causing injury to them or others. In 2005, 42-year-old Dondi Johnson was arrested by police officer Nicole Leake. She testified that she did not belt him into the police van because he had been arrested for public urination and his bladder may have been full. By the time they arrived at her district office, he was immobile on the floor of the police van. She thought he was faking an injury. Eventually, two officers decided to carry Johnson to a radio car and took him to the hospital. When asked about his injuries, Johnson explained that he hit his head and fell when the van made a sharp turn. After undergoing spinal surgery, Johnson was dead 2 weeks later. In the cases I just described, in which people are roughed up in the back of police vehicles, most, if not all, of these detainees scream, yell, or plead for help. What is the protocol there? Is it as discretionary as the seatbelting issue? If someone in police custody is in distress, what are officers supposed to do? So the Supreme Court gives a little guidance in this area. The Eighth Amendment says that excessive bail shall not be required, nor excessive fines imposed, nor cruel and unusual punishment inflicted. cruel and unusual punishment is usually thought about in terms of issues like the death penalty or cases of police force. Yet the Eighth Amendment has also provided a framework for how medical treatment is delivered to prisoners. In the case of Estelle versus Gamble, an inmate tried to file suit against the Texas Department of Corrections because of a back injury he sustained while carrying bales of cotton while in prison. He claimed that he was punished with solitary confinement when he complained of back and chest pains. He was eventually found to have had an irregular heartbeat. The court decided in 1976 that Gamble was not necessarily a victim of cruel and unusual punishment because he was inadvertently denied care, but that if a person is denied care on purpose, that is cruel and unusual. Go figure. So criminal justice authorities cannot be deliberately indifferent to the medical problems of prisoners. 16 days before Freddie's death, on April 3, 2015, Policy 1114, which dictates the procedures for persons in police custody for the Baltimore Police Department, was updated. The 15-page policy stated that once an individual is detained or arrested, the transport can only be interrupted upon direct observation of a life-threatening incident. The memo continues to direct officers to ensure the safety of the detainee and ensure the medical treatment for the detainee is obtained when necessary or requested at the nearest emergency medical facility. Section 156 of this policy also indicates procedures for transport in vehicles and states that the arresting officer should ensure that the detainee is secured with the provided seatbelt or restraining device. All passengers, regardless of age and seat location, shall be restrained by seatbelts or other authorized restraining devices. Section 6 of this policy is where we see the murkiness of these types of directives. Upon arresting a person who is ill or seriously injured, determine if a medic should be requested or if the detainee can be transported to a hospital in a departmental transport vehicle. Seems like the officer's discretion is key here. After Freddie's death, the Baltimore police amended the policy to make clear what is required of officers and why. The updated policy, 1114, requires intervention when prisoners make a medical complaint and more guidelines around prisoner safety and care. These reforms, if observed, may be able to reduce injury or death. But that if is so powerful, considering police reforms and policy updates have been happening for centuries. Maybe this time it will make a difference.
During the trials, the prosecution hinged a lot of their argument on the fact that the officers received the policy 1114 update 16 days before Freddie's arrest, and so knew better than to not seatbelt him. They called administrative and IT staff to testify that the cops received the email. The defense argued that the cops receive over 1,000 emails in a month and rarely check them. They wouldn't read the 80 pages of attachments on that email. Plus, there are only a handful of computers in the district station, and they're often not working. And patrol officers are expected to be on the street, not hanging around on computers. A retired BPD officer explained that the sharing and updating of general orders used to involve a paper system. Officers would sign each page to mark that they'd read the policy. To save money, BPD began emailing updates to officers, but without a system for ensuring receipt. Part of the recent DOJ consent decree calls for IT upgrades in Baltimore to allow for electronic verification. The prosecution focused such a large part of the cases against the officers around the bureaucratic transmission of policy. These arguments fail to address the underlying issue. Police officers don't learn how to behave from policy. Not one officer that testified said that they seatbelted prisoners in vans, regardless of policy. This has been confirmed by all of the officers with whom we spoke. It's not because they are all heartless. They seatbelt prisoners in cars. Vans are tight and awkward, and they learn from watching fellow officers to put prisoners into them without seatbelting them. BPD culture has not sensitized them to how dangerous this can be. I discussed this issue with Professor Seth Stoughton, former police officer.
So I wonder if that's something that you've heard or experienced, the difference between classroom and field training.
Oh, Lord, yes. I don't know a single officer, and I know hundreds if not thousands of officers, I don't know a single officer who has not heard some version of the phrase, forget everything you learned in the academy, now you're going to learn how we really do it here on the streets.
Doing it by the book, he explains, is often seen as a negative. The problem, he says, has a lot to do with the size of the book.
It's also important to understand the nature of police department policy and procedure manuals. They are both exhaustive and labyrinthine. They run into the hundreds of pages, and many of them are more than that. So the NYPD's patrol guide is something like 1,600 pages long. The rules are so numerous and sometimes so complicated that I think it is practically impossible for an officer to know them all and abide by all of them all of the time. So what ends up happening is officers ignore them. They come up with what we might call standard field operating procedures that become totally normal and look very little like some of the procedures that are in the book.
I'm not sure even the DOJ's consent decree can address such a systemic issue. Not seatbelting Freddie Gray in a van is one thing, but not seeking medical care for him seems like obvious neglect, not to mention cruel and heartless. More than one of the officers in the case refer to Freddie exaggerating or faking his distress, what they call jailitis. I spoke with Neil Franklin, former BPD director of training, who testified in two of the trials. Freddie should have gotten medical attention the minute he was screaming and dragging his legs, Franklin said, or before that, when he asked for an inhaler.
The only person who can make a determination as to whether or not they need medical attention is the person themselves, and that would have been Freddie Gray in his case. And no one listened to him. No one got him the medical attention that he was asking for within a timely fashion.
Do you think that this phenomenon called jailitis, where prisoners are faking injury or illness, is so widespread?
You know, does it happen? Yes, it happens. You do have people who are arrested who do fake injuries and illnesses. And it's just part of the process. So you get them the medical attention they need. Once it's been, that medical practitioner then makes a determination as to what's what, and then you just go along with it. Look, you're working. You're going to get paid one way or the other.
Right.
What does it matter? What does it matter that you call for an EMT or transport them to the hospital? You're working. You know, it's not like it's taking you someplace that's going to be harmful to you or whatever. It's your job. And at the end of the day, most people don't fake injuries or illnesses because they realize it's only going to prolong their release. So
yeah,
That's why it's minimal. So always side on caution and make the effort. Make the call. It's just that simple. The paramedics will come to you. You don't even have to go anywhere. They'll come to you. So I don't get it, other than maybe being an emotional decision as to why you don't call for medical attention, because, you know, is there this thing that, well, if they're faking it, then it's like they're scamming me and I don't want to give the impression of being scammed. And, hey, you're not being scammed. No. You ask the person, hey, Mr. Gray, hey, it's my job to get you medical attention if you think you need it. Do you need medical attention? I'll call a paramedic right now. You do? Okay. You know, I'm not a medical practitioner. I can't make the decision, so I'm going to call you the paramedic. I'm going to be honest with you. When I made arrests of people and I suspected, you know, if I saw a scratch on them, the first thing I'd say to them, and I did it every time, hey, do you need medical attention? Can I get you an ambulance? And I let them make that determination. And if they say yes, I call it in, get an ambulance there, they assess them. If they have to take them, they take them. If they don't, they release them, and then I take them to the detention center. Done it time and time again, and many, many conscientious and good police officers have done it also.
Of all the officers working in the Western District that day, it has always sort of puzzled me that Porter would be the first to respond to Goodson's backup call. Porter was working Sector 4 on April 12th, which includes Sandtown and Gilmore Homes, where Freddie was arrested. In terms of proximity, it would have been most convenient for Officer Jackson to go out of district to respond to Druid Hill and Dolphin. Jackson was working in Sector 1, covering the southernmost part of the Western. Officer Novak was also nearby, headed down to Front Street in the Central District to get gas, according to his trial testimony. And that's not the only puzzling thing about Stop 4. Not everyone recalled Goodson's call for backup in quite the same way, or at all. Sergeant Alicia White, for example, she was holding things down at the station that morning, including monitoring the calls coming over the dispatch radio, and she didn't mention that call in either of her two statements to investigators, on April 12th and 17th. Curious. Officer Mark Gladhill, in his interview on April 26th, did recall Goodson's call for backup, but he was insistent that it came over the radio after he saw Goodson in the transport van up on North Avenue at what's considered Stop 5. Gladhill isn't sure about a lot in his statement, and why would he be? Investigators waited 14 days to interview him. But the timing of the Stop 4 call is one thing he seems certain of. It was definitely after, Gladhill said repeatedly about hearing the call for Stop 4 20 to 30 minutes after he'd left Stop 5. What happened during the approximately 8-minute long Stop 4 is not shown on any CCTV footage made public or played in court. Druid Hill and Dolphin is in an area of the city that is heavily monitored by City Watch cameras. There are 24 of them clustered within just a couple of blocks. However, BPD only uploaded footage from 3 cameras, which allegedly captured the stop. Only they don't really capture the stop at all. Footage from Cam 4A at Stoddard Court and Druid Hill Avenue is just over 5 minutes long and captures a transport van driving south down Druid Hill Avenue just below Dolphin Street at 9 a.m. and 19 seconds. This, we are to assume, marks Goodson's arrival at Stop 4, though it's never been entirely clear where he parked. The two other chunks of footage from the stop seem to show the van's departure. There's CCTV 2015, or Cam 4B, and CCTV 2018, or Cam 4C, both of which are located one block over from Druid Hill Avenue. At 9:08 and 7 seconds, Cam 4B shows a van on Hoffman Street, which connects Druid Hill to McCullough, and turning left. Seconds later, at 9:08 and 16 seconds, Cam 4C captures a van making another left, from McCullough onto Dolphin Street. In none of this footage is the license plate to the van clear, or anything else that identifies it as the van transporting Freddie Gray. At least 5 other cameras located along Druid Hill Avenue could and should have captured this stop from multiple angles. Stop 4 should have had the most video evidence of any stop. Because Officer Goodson has never given a statement about the events of April 12th, our understanding of the stop entirely depends on the word of Officer Porter, and there is no sign of him or his vehicle on what little footage we do have. There is also no sign of Officer Porter or the transport van on footage taken by a surveillance camera at a nearby Head Start building. According to the Baltimore Sun, investigators visited the Head Start located at Dolphin and McCullough on April 20th and asked to see footage from April 12th between 8:55 and 9 a.m. The camera points at the intersection of Druid Hill and Dolphin and does not rotate. It allegedly only shows a police car driving through the intersection at 8:57, so way too early to be Officer Porter. A Sun reporter asked to view even more footage and discovered a transport van driving through the intersection at 8:54 and 32 seconds. Too early to be Goodson, according to the official narrative. But what about after 9 a.m., when the transport van should have, according to the timeline, driven through the Dolphin and Druid Hill intersection? The Sun doesn't mention any post-9 a.m. footage, but I don't like to leap to conclusions. So I emailed reporter Kevin Rector to ask how extensive his review was. Unfortunately, I haven't heard back. Why would investigators ask to see such a limited window of time anyway? Remember, Stop 4 was disclosed to the public on the same day that the investigators visited Head Start. The CCTV footage was made public just a few days later. If investigators had seen the Stop 4 CCTV footage by April 20th, they would have known Goodson didn't arrive until just after 9 a.m., according to the timestamps. And if they hadn't reviewed the CCTV footage yet, all the more reason to see as much as possible at Head Start, right? Investigators also visited a convenience store at the intersection of Druid Hill and Dolphin on April 20th, asking to see its surveillance footage. Unfortunately, anything it might have captured from April 12th was gone. They were kind of late, because the camera only had a 6-day record, a store clerk told the Baltimore Sun. If they came the second or third day, they could have found it. BPD could have canvassed the area for surveillance footage and witnesses long before April 20th. The location of Stop 4 is made abundantly clear on the police dispatch audio, evidence that was clearly informing their early investigative efforts. why did they wait 8 days before trying to gather evidence for stop four? Ultimately, BPD does not provide much evidence to verify the location, time, or circumstances around stop four. They provide no video footage except brief moments of a white van coming and going. There are inconsistencies around the call for help and Porter's response. And Porter's interactions with Freddie Gray are based entirely on his own recollections. We don't rule out the possibility that such footage exists. BPD could release it tomorrow and quiet all our suspicions. Actually, that would be the best case scenario.
But we seem to have many police officers in this case who didn't call a paramedic at multiple stops while Freddie was in evolving states of apparent distress. Were they all afraid of feeling scammed? Or were they concerned with what happens once an ambulance is called? Namely, someone asking, "What happened here?"
In his statement to the FIT detectives on April 17th, Porter described pulling Freddie up from his position lying on his stomach on the floor of the wagon. "Was he still on the floor, or did you help him onto the bench?" TL asked him to clarify. "He was still on the floor," Porter said. At no point does Porter volunteer that he offered Freddie any additional physical assistance. Towards the end of the interview, however, Detective Anderson refers to Porter helping Freddie back up onto the bench. Where he got this detail from is unclear, but it didn't come from Porter's mouth, at least not during his official recorded interview. At trial, helping Freddie onto the bench was suddenly a big part of Porter's recollection of stop four. He even did a demonstration, followed by this carefully considered exchange with his attorney, Gary Proctor.
"Did you lift him up and pick him up and put him on the bench? How did that work?"
That would be physically impossible to pick up a 150-pound man. I weigh 220 pounds. To physically pick him up and put him someplace? There's no way I'd be able to do that. He assisted me in helping himself kneel, and he obviously assisted me in sitting on the bench."
In other words, Freddie asked for help and Porter provided it, because he's a nice guy, not because Freddie really needed it. During cross-examination, prosecutor Michael Schatzow appeared ready to strike on this issue. "When you were interviewed by Detectives Teal and Anderson, you never say that Mr. Gray helped in any way to get from the floor to the bench, did you?" he asked.
"I didn't elaborate on how I got him from the floor to the bench," Porter said. "I thought it was obvious."
Unfortunately, I was giving Michael Schatzow too much credit. This turned into one of the more maddening exchanges heard in court across all four trials, because apparently, Schatzow actually did think that Porter had told the detectives that he helped Freddie from the floor to the bench. His beef with Porter was one of semantics. "You never said I put him on the bench, but it was really with his assistance," Schatzow accused. But Porter never said he put Freddie on the bench at all. From there, Schatzow repeatedly referred to dialogue between Porter and the detectives that did not actually occur.
"Didn't you repeatedly tell them I put him on the bench?" Schatzow asked.
"No, Porter did not, Schatzow."
"You told them you put him on the bench. You placed him on the bench, correct?"
"No, absolutely incorrect, Schatzow." The prosecutor even read a few lines from Porter's statement, presenting his own inferences as if they came straight from Porter's mouth.
"Part of what you tell her when it comes to putting Mr. Gray on the bench, so you say, 'I pull him up,' is that correct?"
"Damn it, Schatzow, Porter wasn't talking about pulling Freddie up onto the bench. In fact, he specifically clarified that he was sitting Freddie up on the floor of the wagon." Throughout this contentious exchange, Porter's attorneys sat back and watched, objecting just once when Schatzow somewhat sarcastically asked Porter if he'd studied his own statement. Oh, the irony.
There were two more stops, stops 5 and 6, according to the police, that the van made before finally delivering Freddie Gray to the Western District Station. But here's the thing. When they arrived there, Freddie wasn't alone in the back of the van. Next time on Undisclosed.
Hi, listeners. I promised you at the top of the program that I'd tell you about how you can help Mr. Perry. You all were captivated by Mr. Perry's story as told in the undisclosed addendum featuring Dee Watkins on March 16th, 2017. His unique perspective as a witness to Freddie Gray's arrest and a longtime resident of the Sandtown Winchester neighborhood of Baltimore evoked an outpouring of support from our audience. Undisclosed is proud to provide listeners with a way to help. As you heard on the addendum, Mr. Perry is a military veteran who bears the responsibility of caring for a garden in Sandtown, Winchester. Unfortunately, Mr. Perry's age and disability make it incredibly difficult for him to maintain the land. Well, we think we found someone that can help Mr. Perry do just that. The Sixth Branch is a Baltimore-based nonprofit that works with veterans to lead community service efforts. In the nearly 8 years since its founding, the Sixth Branch has led more than 4,000 volunteers during hundreds of service projects and specializes in vacant lot revitalization. Given Mr. Perry's history as a veteran and the Sixth Branch's distinguished track record, we think the partnership is perfect for the project. Check out the Sixth Branch's great work at www.thesixthbranch.org. That's www.thesixthbranch.org. There, you'll find out about the organization's history, its projects, and most importantly, how to donate. Donations will go to the beautification and upkeep of the garden. Also, the Sixth Branch is planning a day of service at the garden, and folks near Baltimore will soon learn how they can visit to help out. We'll also make sure to blast out the links all week on our social media, so you're going to see it on our Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram handle, @UndisclosedPod. And even better, we're going to have Scott Goldman, the executive director of the Sixth Branch, on the addendum this week to talk about the project. Listeners, you've stepped up for us in the past, and we know you're going to do it again. Let's come together to support Mr. Perry and his garden. Donate to the Sixth Branch today. Thanks. And now let's move on to the credits. Undisclosed: The Killing of Freddie Gray, Episode 6, was co-produced in part by Justine Barron and Amelia McDonald Perry. Justine, Amelia, Dr. Marcia Chatlin, and Rabia Chaudhry co-wrote the episode. Jason Henderson helped with research for the episode, and Saad Chaudhry consulted. We also got a lot of help from Lane Keniston. She spoke to witnesses for us and got some follow-up information that was absolutely crucial to this episode's production. Thanks, Lane. And on that production, our audio was produced by Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media and the two great podcasts, Crime Writers On and These Are Their Stories. Methil Telhan is the super producer that brings everything together and makes sure that you get a new Undisclosed podcast every Monday and Thursday at 6 p.m. Our sponsors ensure that we can continue to fund and produce this investigation, so we want to make sure that we give thanks to our sponsor, Casper. Really, Casper, we appreciate you so much. This investigation has consumed so many of our hours, and the requests for police records and copies of court information just don't come cheap. Sponsorship helps tremendously with these costs, so again, Casper, thank you, both for the sponsorship and the comfortable night's sleep. Patrick Cortez and Ramiro Marquez composed Undisclosed theme music. Hey, did you know that our theme music is up for a Webby Award? How cool is that? Like, seriously, the Webby Awards are considering all of the different themes Patrick has composed for the various cases. I know y'all hate when I do the long URL read, so instead I'll just tell you how to vote by giving you the short version of the website. It's www.vote.webbyawards.com. On that website, if you search Undisclosed, you're going to find the box that'll allow you to vote for the theme music. You can also check out our social media profile. We plug the vote there pretty hard. Voting closes on April 20th, so if you haven't already, go vote for Patrick's awesome theme music. Nina Mooser and Christy Williams design and maintain our website. That's www.undisclosed-podcast.com. And Baluki, the mysterious Baluki, does our graphics. Stop by on Thursdays at 6 p.m. for the Undisclosed Addendum featuring Dee Watkins for a discussion about this week's episode. Dee brings a fresh perspective to our investigation that makes for some really powerful audio. You're absolutely going to love it. Make sure you follow Dee on Twitter at DeeWatkinsWorld. Ask him questions about the episode with the hashtag Freddie Gray and the hashtag UDAddendum. Lastly and leastly, Undisclosed's executive producer is Dennis Robinson, and he looks forward to Thursday for the Undisclosed Addendum featuring Dee Watkins. Until then.